Hello everybody and welcome to today's podcast. Today it's my great pleasure to have with us Mark Dodds, who is a fabric technologist, a textile sourcing expert and a production consultant. And Mark is going to help us answer some of those questions that we all have right now regarding fabric sourcing, sustainability and all the nuances in between that many members are having problems with. Mark, welcome to today's podcast.
Hi there, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Most welcome. It's lovely to have you here and thank you so much for sparing your time to talk with us today. So let's move into our first question. Mark, can you give us an introduction to your career path and explain your role as a fabric and sourcing technician?
Yep, sure. So it was all a bit of a happy accident, really. I went to Leeds University and studied fabric, textile management, actually, the course was called. It was like a business course tagged on to a textile course. And at the time, I was more interested in like the business aspect. But I saw it through. And then, as it is in the fashion textile industry, it's about who you know. So I got a call from a friend who'd got a job in London at a supplier, like a garment supplier, and I figured, okay, let's see what this is all about. I moved down to London and did that, and then really, I've ever since been in that role or similar. So, basically, a fabric technologist is the person who normally sits within a garment supplier or a retailer and deals with the quality aspect of fabrics and raw material development and testing and due diligence and all that kind of stuff, just to make sure that the fabrics are fit for purpose. So I did that for a few years and then got an opportunity with ASOS when they were kind of not starting out, but it was the early days of ASOS and they needed someone to help with fabric sourcing. And because I had the connections within the industry at the time, I then moved from a more technical role into a sourcing role, which was more kind of creative, I suppose, in the sense of sourcing fabrics for the designers and the buyers in terms of like the aesthetic, etc., etc. And since then, I've kind of evolved more into, well, not really a jack of all trades, but I suppose a little bit more broad in what I do. So it's now a bit of a hybrid between the creative side of sourcing fabrics, but still the technical side of ensuring that the quality is correct, the raw materials are from the right locations, that the fabrics are fit for purpose, and even more so nowadays that the fabrics are sustainably sourced and having that kind of aspect in the background, because sustainability is obviously becoming a lot more important. So that's where I am right now. It's all been, I don't know, 20 years now of happy accidents, moving from one thing to the next, but
organic growth
suited me well,
Mark.
So far.
Yeah. Organic learning is fantastic. It's great. We'll kind of segue straight into the next question, actually. In your view, has COVID stimulated and accelerated the race within the brands to sustainable fabric sourcing?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer, really. I think on the face of it, the obvious answer is yes, because over the last year and a half, sustainability, not just within textiles, but sustainability in general, has become, it's become to the forefront of the political agenda. See, I suppose that's kind of driven business to kind of up the ante with that respect and kind of make them, you know, talk about it more, I suppose, and shout about what they're doing more. But really, if you've been in the business for the last 5 to 10 years, it has been an organic growth, like you say, of kind of focusing more on sustainability. I think a lot of the brands and retailers really have been really serious about this probably for the last 5 years. And kind of doing a lot of work in the background. I think if you remember, you know, Marks and Spencer launched their Plan A. I don't know when that was. That was probably at least 10 years ago. So, you know, the big brands have been quite serious about it for quite some time. But I think COVID really has, because it's brought the whole thing into the kind of pop culture almost, hasn't it? Like, you know, everyone's talking about it now, even people that aren't interested in sourcing, whether it's food or textiles or whatever, even kind of those people are now hearing about it every day. So I think, although I don't necessarily think it's accelerated the kind of the work that's going on necessarily, but it's certainly accelerated the conversation, you know, and especially the conversation within the wider world rather than specifically the textile business.
And I think those brands as well, it's all, as you say, front of mind, but it's been used much more for marketing now, isn't it, than it ever was before?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there is an element of that, that there will be a lot of brands probably over the last year or so that have jumped on the bandwagon, so to speak, and maybe haven't been doing anything, or they have a business model that potentially that is counterproductive to the whole point of sustainability, and maybe those types of brands are jumping on a bandwagon in terms of, okay, well, we've got to do something now. We've got to be seen to be doing something, even if it's not necessarily inherent to our brand.
Very interesting. Yeah, it's things are changing so quickly. Mark, can the fashion industry switch to a circular economy? And how can brands make that first step?
So circular is really tricky within fashion. I think if there's lots of elements. So because I work in kind of supply chain, that's kind of where I'm most comfortable. So I'm kind of downstream. And that side of it really, with from a circularity point of view, is becoming quite easy. And although it's not easy, there are processes and businesses out there that are kind of making it easy for brands. So I'm talking about kind of recycling cotton back into yarn, for example. So that element of circularity, of taking either a post-consumer waste or a pre-consumer piece of cotton waste and turning it back into a viscose fibre. So that's all kind of set up and past its pilot stage, and you know, they're kind of commercially trading, those businesses that do that. So that there's kind of the downstream side of it is kind of set up and working quite well. But the problem with full circularity is that you've got to be taking that post-consumer waste and getting it back into the supply chain. And really that depends entirely on consumer behaviour. You know, a brand doesn't really have control of what their customer does with the garment when it reaches its end of life. You know, we can influence what the customer does with that garment through incentive schemes or marketing or whatever it might be, but we don't have control of that, and we can't force a customer to give us that garment back or take it to the right reprocessor or wherever. So although I think theoretically the fashion industry can switch to fully circular, it really, that kind of key aspect of that is the consumer behaviour, and as a brand we can do as much as possible to influence that behaviour, but really I think for the fashion business and any other business to become fully circular, we need the help of government and legislation to force that kind of final piece of the jigsaw. I think if you think about the plastic bag situation in supermarkets, you know, that 5p levy made such a huge impact on consumer behaviour. Even though it's no money to someone if they're doing a weekly shop, what's 5p on your £50 weekly shop? It's nothing, but that 5p actually made such a huge difference. And it's those kind of pieces of legislation, I think, that would really need to be introduced to kind of close that loop. And I think once we've got that circular, once we've got that kind of post-consumer piece sorted, the rest of it kind of falls into place.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I guess that regulation has to flow all the way through the supply chain, doesn't it? Right from the very beginning, all the way through, with transparency, I guess.
Yeah, it would do. Yeah, I mean, there's so many pieces of the supply chain in textiles. You know, there's so many people in the chain, and a lot of brands and companies are buying fabrics, for example, from wholesalers and traders because that's the only way they can procure what they need in terms of, you know, the minimum quantities or the price they need or whatever it might be. And so, you know, when you're buying it from a wholesaler, you don't necessarily have visibility of where the fabric's coming from. And sometimes the wholesaler might not even know, you know, they might have bought it from someone, another wholesaler in the Far East, for example, that have then had it made in a mill somewhere else. So it's so convoluted that with the best will in the world, sometimes you can't get that visibility. And if you do want full circularity, you do need to be able to see every step in that journey, because otherwise, how do you prove that? Well, to yourself and to your customers, how do you prove that the fabric you're selling or the garment you're selling is a circular product, you know? And I think the buzz line I quite often use with the whole circular thing in fashion is, you know, we need to make less stuff. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on circularity and sustainable fabrics and sourcing recycled polyester and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But ultimately, the problem in fashion is we make too much stuff. And, you know, if we're chasing trends and stuff, you know, if you're chasing a fleeting trend, if that's your business model, then why are you kind of shouting about the fact your fabrics are made sustainably when you know full well that garment's going to live for a month or two and then die an undignified death somewhere.
Feeding the problem, aren't they? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Mark, exactly. I think, like, you know, I was going to say, you're kind of, when you say you're feeding the beast, you know, the fast fashion kind of the world, although it's circular, you're still always going to be feeding in virgin material at the beginning to kind of prop up your business model. So that circular model, if you do get to that point ever, it's almost going to be like a rolling snowball. You know, this circular business is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, because you're going to be constantly feeding it with raw material ultimately, because every business wants to grow. And, you know, the idea, if you want to be fully, truly circular, I suppose what that suggests is that the raw material that you have within your business it's always the same. You know, it doesn't diminish, it doesn't grow, it stays the same, because it's going round in a loop and being recycled, etc., etc. And if you're thinking about it in that sense, that's not a growth model, is it? Because you're using a static amount of product and just reconstituting it. So in order for businesses to grow, which they need to do, they're always going to be needing to feed off some form of virgin raw material. So I guess in the long-winded answer to your question is, yes, fashion could become circular, but, you know, theoretically it can, but will there be a desire to become truly circular when the fashion brands will want that growth every season, every year, to survive?
Yes, it is. It's a big ask, isn't it? Mark, just nipping back into one of your answers there, with regards to regulation, how fast do you think that will come through? Are we looking at like a 3, 5, 10 year objective here? How fast do you think the world will actually, you know, if you look at what's happening with the G7, etc., what's the appetite for regulation?
I think it's quite strong. Like, I don't have the kind of insight into what is actually going on from that point of view, but being within the industry and hearing people talking and stuff, I've got a feeling that there is legislation coming in the next 5 years, maybe. That's kind of my hunch, that would directly affect the textile business. And whether that's about landfill or the raw material sourcing part of it, or carbon reporting, I don't know. I don't know the detail, but I think within the next 5 years, fashion businesses and probably many other businesses will be forced to do certain things to reduce their footprint, so to speak.
Yeah, it's expected.
What I do know is there's people within the fashion industry that there is a collaborative kind of piece of work going on. You know, I do know people that are on various groups that are talking to the government to shape this legislation. So yeah, there is work going on behind the scenes, and how quickly that kind of comes to fruition, I'm not sure, but I think about 5 years.
Okay. Mark, next question. Are the mills and fibre companies keeping up with the demand for sustainable textiles?
I think not. okay. I think a year ago I would have said yes, because even a year ago it was, you know, a lot of these sustainable fibres could be considered niche because they were a little bit more expensive, or they were focused in certain parts of the world that the mass market wasn't sourcing from, for example. But over the last year, and I don't know if this is about sustainable fibres in specifically, but there have been lots of supply issues over the last year for fibres generally, and the prices have gone crazy. You know, and it hasn't necessarily been a COVID thing. It's been more probably an uneven demand thing, where COVID has caused the Western world to close down, so demand has fallen through the floor, and then the fibre prices have gone down a lot as a result because the demand has gone down. And then when the West started opening up again, the demand went through the roof and the prices went through the roof. And as a result, we've seen crazy fluctuations in price and also availability of different fibre types. And then there has been an issue with organic cotton and FSC viscose, which is a sustainable form of viscose. I use this term sustainable a little bit loosely there, because viscose is quite a difficult fibre to make. But when we talk about FSC viscose, what that means is it's sourced from renewably managed forests. So you're not deforesting and stuff like that. So in the viscose spectrum, FSC is a better version of, you know, your regular viscose. And there has been an issue over the last year with availability of that and the organic cotton. And I think that's probably down to these fluctuations in prices and the kind of the fluctuation in demand caused by COVID. So although there was probably enough of that fiber available to satisfy the market over the course of a year, let's say, because the demand fluctuated so much, I think that's what caused the problems, because the suppliers couldn't actually manage that kind of flow of material into the market to match the crazy fluctuations in demand that COVID caused. I do also have a question over, you know, I have my own internal question over recycled polyester, because that's marketed as a product that is made from plastic bottles. And a lot of the brands that use it market it in the sense of, you know, this garment uses 20 bottles, and there's some people using bottles as a logo, etc., etc. And it's all great marketing, but just my insight alone into the amount of millions of plastic bottles that I've been involved with turning back into fabric, I can't actually believe there's enough plastic bottles in the world to make all this fabric. So I do have a bit of a question over, when you say, are they keeping up with demand? I think with the recycled polyester, the answer is yes, because whenever you place an order for recycled polyester, it's there. And it has the certificates to prove where it comes from, etc. But I do question where those bottles came from in the first place, you know, because
scary.
A natural business to keep up with demand, if there's a company supplying bottles and the demand increases for bottles, they make more bottles. But with the recycled polyester thing, you can't make more bottles. You need to find them or gather them.
Yeah.
And that isn't something that's that easy, you know. If those bottles aren't there, then where is this recycled poly coming from? And I do sometimes feel a bit dubious about that side of it when you consider how convoluted the supply chains are. And, you know, even with a certification system that proves your fabric is from a bottle, there's not necessarily any proof to show you where that bottle came from. You know, was it gathered as waste, or was it made specifically to be recycled? If you get where I'm coming from.
You know exactly where you're coming from. Here comes the whole transparency issue again. And not transparency, I guess it's more traceability, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And fine-tuning it. It's interesting because we have the technologies to be able to do it, don't we?
The traceability, we do, yeah. I mean, if we're talking recycled poly still, I mean, there is a very robust system of traceability in place, and the big brands use it. And it works. You know, you can get the certificates that prove that your fabric has been made from polyester chips that came from plastic bottles. You can verify all of that right down the supply chain. And that's actually quite easy to do. I think for me, the gap comes with where those bottles were procured. That's where it's hard. I think, you know, collecting waste is globally extremely fragmented. You know, there's all sorts of companies, and in some countries the waste maybe is even collected by the public, the general public, you know, and then sold as a commodity. So how do you trace that part? I think I would almost say that section of it is impossible. Because these plastic bottles are coming from all over the place. You know, in Europe there's systems where, you know, the public give them over into banks that are located in supermarkets, but you don't know where the public got those bottles from. And in Asia, there's more of a ad hoc system where people just collect waste from the street, particularly, and sort it themselves, and then they'll sell the bottles or whatever it is to a trader. So it's that part of it that I'm not sure that part of the loop would ever get closed.
Yeah, it's an underground market, isn't it? Very hard.
I think so.
It's great insights there, Mark. Thank you so much. That's brilliant. Mark, this is a big question for you. Which is the most sustainable base fibre? Is it cotton or polyester?
Well, it's interesting you asked me this because I was just doing some work on this yesterday. I wasn't comparing cotton with polyester, but I was comparing cotton with other cellulosic fibres just to see how they all sit. And the short answer is cotton is more sustainable than polyester. But there's never an easy answer in textiles. So, I mean, I would justify that answer in the sense of if you measure cotton and polyester from an impact point of view, cotton scores highly because it's a natural product. It's not using virgin resources, et cetera, whereas polyester is using a finite resource. It's using oil, and it's got a lot of chemical processing to get it to the point where it's a fibre. So in that kind of simplistic way, cotton could be seen as the more sustainable base fibre. But if you look at it in a broader picture, you know, cotton is a huge user of land and water and potentially pesticides, depending on how it's farmed. And if you took globally the kind of cotton production globally and how many millions of tons that is and how much land that uses, then there might be an argument to say that polyester actually is more sustainable because the production of polyester is focused in a smaller number of big, efficient factories that are churning out millions of tons of polyester fibre rather than it being millions of acres of land, for example. And I think with polyester, there's so much going on right now with changing the chemical composition of polyester to make it sustainable, that there might be, even within the next 5 years, let's say, that polyester that we know, as we know it, will have changed, and it won't actually be made from oil anymore. It'll be made from some kind of bio-based polymer. So you can get polyester now that's made from soybean or cornstarch, and that's becoming a lot more common. And I think once the industry gets to the point where it's more efficient to make it in that sense than it is to make it from oil, then when you're looking at that impact kind of graph, poly versus cotton, you might find that a bio-based poly, for argument's sake, is now more sustainable than cotton because it's using less land or less water, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an ever-moving feast. But right now, cotton is definitely seen as the more sustainable fibre of the two, but within the next 5 to 10 years it might have completely turned on its head just because of the way the industry's moving.
So much innovation.
I would also say there's lots of different types of cotton as well, and the same is happening with cotton. You know, that if you took organic cotton, that is really sustainable, and that's almost one of the most sustainable fibres. But if you compare that to conventional cotton, there's a huge difference just between those two, let alone between a cotton and a polyester. So even within a single fibre type, there's quite a large range of sustainability, if you know what I mean. So, you know, it's not a simple question to answer, and the answer tomorrow might be different.
Mark, are you seeing new innovations in the way cotton is grown?
Yes, very much. So the whole organic thing, that's been going on for, you know, years. Everyone knows organic cotton, but that's becoming a lot more popular within the marketplace and prices are coming down. So although organic cotton, I wouldn't say that's an innovation anymore because it's kind of old hat, but the innovation, I suppose, within that space is that it's becoming more mainstream. But there's plenty of other stuff going on with cotton. You know, there's hydroponics, which is growing cotton not in a field, so growing it in a lab, which could potentially be scaled up to a factory, for example, where the cotton doesn't require natural sunlight, it doesn't require lots of irrigation. So there's that side of things. That's quite early days, but there is stuff going on there. There's also GMO. So GMO is a dirty word because there's fears around it and stuff like that. But there is an argument to kind of say that GMO could be good for the textile business, because if you can make a cotton that requires less water and doesn't require pesticides, then it certainly makes that ethical argument of using land for fashion a lot easier to argue. Mm-hmm. When really we probably should be using land for food. So, you know, although GMO might not take off in the world of food, it could be a thing that takes off in the world of textiles, because if you can grow cotton more efficiently and not take that land away from food use or from rainforests or whatever else it could be used for, then all of a sudden that makes your kind of ethical argument a lot stronger, because you've got this lovely natural fibre that's got all of those cotton qualities that we like, but it's not using all of the land and all of the water and all of the pesticides and all of that, which it traditionally would have been using 10 years ago. So I do think there's an argument for GMO within products for textiles. You know, if we're not consuming them, then those fears should be allayed a bit. And fashion, you know, we can see it as a frivolous use of resource, really. So if we can kind of lower that impact and continue to be able to make clothes, then that's a good thing.
So much going on, isn't there? It's incredible. So many innovations everywhere. It's fantastic. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Mark, could you give our listeners some advice then? If our listeners are looking to source a responsibly, looking for responsible cotton or polyester, what should they look out for, Mark? What advice would you give them?
There's so much to look out for, but my main thing would be know your supply base in capital letters. I think if you're sourcing textile products, you've got to know your supply base. And it's not a case of just knowing the agent in London that shows you the fabric swatches at Premier Vision, for example. It's about knowing the mill that made that product, knowing where they dye that product, asking the questions where they bought the yarn from. You know, that there's so many pieces of the chain that the kind of typical designer, let's say, working in a brand might not be aware of, that there's a lot of pitfalls, you know, with the whole responsible sourcing thing. And you can ask for a certificate, but if you don't know your supply base and where every part of it is coming from, then how really do you know that certificate is correct? You know, I mean, I'm not mm-hmm. saying that it would be a fake certificate necessarily, but how do you know it's for your actual piece of fabric that you bought and not for another piece of fabric that was sold the day before or part of a bigger order that had that certificate, you know? So there are certificates and it's fine to ask for those, and you should, because that's the process to prove that the product is recycled or sustainably sourced or whatever it is. But you should also know your supply base and ask those questions, because if you're just buying it from a trader in Europe or London and you don't know where it's coming from, then, I mean, first of all, you like I say, you wouldn't necessarily be able to trust that what you're buying is what you think, but also if you really want to responsibly source something, then you as a buyer need to be responsible and ask mm-hmm. and ask those questions and kind of be interested, rather than just demanding that I need a recycled product and I need it for $3 a meter and I need it to be X color and I need it delivered on this date, you know, which are the normal questions that are normally yeah. asked, and kind of that's all a lot of the buying industry cares about, because the answer to those questions gets their product delivered on time and at the price they want. So fair enough, but if you want it responsibly sourced, then you should be asking more questions than that.
Do you think buyers as well should be expecting to pay a premium for responsibility, for sustainable fabrics? Do you think they'll accept that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%, I think we should be paying more, yeah. I think the expectation is that it depends, you know. I think, and it also depends with the market forces and market fluctuations. I mean, for me, I think we should always be paying more for sustainably sourced products, because there's more going into them, and there's been a race to the bottom within textiles in terms of pricing over the last 30 years. And you can't expect those cheap prices to be maintained if we're sourcing something renewably and responsibly. So there's that argument, first of all. But there's also an ethical argument as well. I think, you know, if a supplier is investing money in new processes and new machinery and new sourcing routes in order to make their product sustainable, then why shouldn't we as buyers pay extra for that product? And then on the third hand, I think the customer in the street who's buying the product needs to understand that they need to pay more as well. Uh-huh. Because, you know, a £10 dress off the internet, although it's the norm now, it shouldn't be, and it isn't a true reflection of the work and the materials that have gone into that product. And, you know, the customer in the street now expects those prices, and that they've almost been trained to assume that those prices are normal, and that they're representative of the product, and really they're not. And if you're sourcing something responsibly, we should all be paying more.
Yeah, another long answer to it's great. No, it's good. You have to question how on earth it can be manufactured and retailed for that price point, don't you? We all have to be responsible.
Exactly.
I guess.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, when you use the word responsibly sourced, that kind of switches the debate a little bit. So, you know, up to now we've been talking about sustainably sourced. So is the product sustainably produced? But when you're talking about responsibly sourced, that kind of opens up a load of other questions, you know, about who you're buying it from and what is their business? Who are the investors of that business? Who are the employees? Are the employees being paid enough? Is there the health and safety in the factories, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So, you know, if you're talking all of those aspects on top of the sustainable raw materials, then 100% we should be paying more for our fabrics and garments.
Great answer. Thank you so much, Mark. My next question, Mark, is a difficult one, but it's one that everybody is so interested in. How close are we to numeric carbon in textiles, and can we trace and measure the carbon footprint of a fabric from fibre to retail? Can we do that now, or how could we do that for the future?
Yeah, so this is a tricky question, and it's not something I'm intimately familiar with, but I know a kind of, I can give a kind of broad answer, and the answer is we can measure carbon of fabric. So there are various tools available online that do give you the carbon footprint of fabrics, and they can give you the water footprint, for example, and the chemical footprint as well, I think. One of the best ones is the HIGG platform. So it's HIGG. Uh-huh. And they actually have an amazing platform that you can put basically any fibre blend into there, and it will churn out at the end the carbon footprint of that fabric. And they base it all on averages, you know, the average land use of cotton and the average chemical use of processing cotton, et cetera, et cetera. But it gives you a very good way of benchmarking fibres against one another. And that goes up to the point at which it reaches the customer, I believe. So they measure the impact of that fabric or garment up to the point where the customer has bought it, because after that stage it's very hard to measure the behavior of the customer and how many times they wash it and how long they'll wear it for, etc., etc., etc. So I think when you know in your question, you said, can you measure the carbon footprint of a fabric from fiber to retail? I think yes, the answer is yes, and there are platforms out there that do that. But retail, beyond retail, that's the tricky part. And I think it goes back to the question earlier about how do we influence and control the consumer behaviour, because without that element, you won't really be able to measure the kind of post-sale aspect of the impact of your products.
Great answer, Mark. Thank you. That's really interesting. Next question, greenwashing. A big issue, I think, at the moment. What's the best way to check the facts? Which other indexes or resources do you recommend for people to avoid greenwashing?
Well, yeah, greenwashing is really hard because there are obvious ways that brands greenwash, and you know, we can call them out on that. But there's also, you know, you can greenwash as a brand without really even realizing it, because you could be doing all the right things, but there might be certain aspects that you just haven't necessarily thought of, for example. I go back to the HIG platform again. I think for me, that seems to be one of the best ones where you can get figures to back up your claims, but it's very much around the raw material and production part of the process. So you can benchmark cotton against polyester and you can show if you've improved, you know, moving from cotton to organic cotton, for example, you can show the figures to back up your decision on that. But there's an inherent greenwashing, I always think, within the fashion business as a whole, and that's down to the price we sell our garments for and the chasing of trends. You know, most fashion businesses are based around designing the latest trend and making sure they're first to market with that trend, but the whole kind of basis of that business model suggests that a year from now that trend has moved on, and so the garments that were designed around that trend are no longer fashionable, and so people don't want them anymore. So again, it goes back to my point earlier, you know, you could do all the right things in the sense of sourcing sustainable raw materials and using ethical factories and all of that, but if you're designing clothes that only have a lifespan of 6 months, that's greenwashing in itself. You're advertising the fact you've got sustainable materials, but you're designing a garment that you don't intend to sell again in 6 months' time, or even 3 months' time, or some cases even 3 weeks' time. So how do you get around that aspect of greenwashing? I think that's a cultural change, rather than anything we can measure with indexes, etc. But going back to like trying to do the right thing, you know, the HIG index is great. RAP is also a really good resource. So RAP is the Waste and Resources Action Program, and they've been going for quite a number of years now, and they encompass all different things, you know, not just textiles. That they're an overarching charity that deals with waste and sustainability and efficient use of resources, and they launched the Sustainable Clothing Action Plan in 2010, I think, originally. And loads of brands signed on to that and made commitments to reduce their carbon, waste and water impacts over 10 years. And RAP just launched SCAP kind of 2.0 in the last couple of months, which is a new declaration that takes them up to 2030 with new targets. And their website's really great. They have a tool which it's not available publicly, but if you are a brand that's signed on to their commitment, they have a tool that measures your carbon, waste and water impacts, and it's based quite heavily around raw materials. So the WRAP website's a really good place to go for general information. I think as a kind of layperson, you couldn't kind of input any data into that and get stuff that's specific to you, but it's a great kind of resource from a learning point of view. If you want to kind of input your own data, then the HIG platform is really good. They have a free kind of test service where you can do 5 products, I think. So that's a really great way where you can benchmark your own products against one another, or you could benchmark your product against competition to see the impact and how yours might be better or worse than the competition. And the Ellen MacArthur Foundation as well, they do a lot of stuff in the fashion space. So it's worth checking their website out as well, because there won't be tools necessarily on their website, but there'll be plenty of links to other tools and resources that'll help you in your sourcing journey. But I think with the whole greenwashing thing, it's just really important to it's really important to just know your supply chain. Like I said, you know, if you want to avoid being accused of greenwashing, you really need to be able to back up all your claims, and the customers will come at you with some random questions. You know, if you're selling organic cotton and you've got the organic certificate, the customers might be asking you, well, which organic system are you using, for example? So you need to know the answer to that. There's more than one. And you need to know the answer, and they might ask you, is it organically grown or is it also organically approved chemicals? And there's a difference between those two aspects, and you need to know the answer to that as well. You know, if you need to really know intimate details about what you're buying if you want to avoid being accused of greenwashing. And that goes back to knowing your supply chain and like your phrase, responsibly sourcing. You know, if you want to truly responsibly source, you really need to know everyone that's making your product, really, or at least every company that's making your product.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in the past, you know, we all have bought from our wholesalers and suppliers with great trust. But I think moving forward, we need more people like yourself, Mark, in this industry, don't we? We need more fabric technologists, and we just need to get so much sharper about what we're doing here. As a whole, it's interesting, really, how the skill sets within our industry are changing and evolving, isn't it?
It's hard. Like fabric technologists now in this country, we're a bit of a rare breed. I think I would like to think I probably know them all, if I'm honest. I at least know all the ones that work in London, and there's not that many of us, and you see them in Paris. Well, before COVID, you used to see them all in Paris and have dinner and stuff, and you know, we are a rare breed, and it seems like it's a bit of a dying breed, because you know, all the production went off to the Far East and Europe. There's not many textile producers left in the UK anymore, so it kind of, that skill set kind of dried up a bit, but I think, like you say, the it is coming back, and it's coming back more in a kind of compliance perspective. So fabric technologists in the UK, at least nowadays, we're less about developing yarns and raw materials and doing that kind of sciencey bit of fabrics, because that's generally taken care of by the experts in the mills. But we are being recruited to do that whole compliance thing. Because first of all, the big brands want to be seen to be doing the right thing and need to be able to back up their claims, but also probably as well because there is this legislation coming, and there's already loads of legislation around chemical compliance and making sure that fabrics don't contain certain chemicals. And that's not about necessarily about the chemicals in a garment causing a rash, for example, although that is an aspect of it. But actually, the whole chemical compliance thing is more concerned with, were any chemicals used in the factory, whether it's in China or Italy or wherever, that could have harmed the workers. And that's what the big focus with the chemical compliance side is. It's not necessarily about, will the chemicals harm the end user? It's about, did the chemicals harm the people making it? And so there is a responsibility now legally for brands in the UK and Europe to be accountable for any damage they might be doing indirectly through a supplier in China or India or wherever it might be. And they need technologists to check all that out. it's a really boring job, and I don't think anyone else would do it. I think only technologists are that way inclined.
It doesn't sound boring at all.
It's interesting when you kind of think about it, and you know, I suppose if you're out there in the factories kind of talking to them, that aspect is interesting. But if you're just gathering certificates, quite often it isn't that interesting. But it's obviously really important, and you need to understand what you're gathering. You couldn't necessarily just have an admin person, for example, gathering certificates for this kind of stuff, because you need to be able to check them and make sure that they are what they say they are. And that requires an element of experience that technologists have.
Fantastic. I really look forward to seeing more clones of yourself, Mark, where our industry needs you. It really, really does. Mark, I'm really conscious of your time, and I know you've got a busy day ahead of you. The last question we have touched on, actually, but I'm just going to ask you in a slightly different way. If you had a wish list, what would the fibres of the future look like, and what innovations would you like to see?
Well, for me, I think I'm kind of, my heart's in menswear. Obviously, it's what I wear, and it's what I originally trained in. So kind of that's where my kind of passion lies, I guess. And the reason I kind of split menswear and ladies' wear out is because the fabrics they use are very different and the fibres they use are very different. And menswear tends to use natural fibres more than women's wear. I'm not really sure why that is. It's probably it's a comfort and drape kind of thing, I suppose. They're just suited more to menswear natural fibres. But as a result, I'm a bit of a champion for natural fibres. And I like nature's over millions of years has evolved these fibres to be the best at what they do. And as a result, those fibres make great clothes. And if we can get those natural fibres to the point where they are sustainably grown and kind of benefiting the environment rather than taking away from it, that's the ultimate goal, I think. And if you talk about organic cotton, for example, that's a low impact fibre, which is amazing because you've got your cotton fibre, which I love and most people love, but you know it's being grown responsibly and it's not damaging the soil and it's not using too much water, etc. But if you take that to the next step, where I mentioned hydroponics earlier, if you can grow cotton indoors in a factory and you can grow it on an industrial scale, then you've got to the point where you're manufacturing rather than growing natural fibers. I suppose that's the holy grail, isn't it? If you look at like viscose and Tencel and those, if you take those kind of cellulosic fibers, we call them, which are made from natural materials, so wood pulp or cotton or linen or whatever it is, and it's been turned into lyocell in a factory, that's actually an extremely efficient way of producing fibre, because you're producing fibre on an industrial scale in a factory rather than growing that fibre and harvesting it and processing it and all of that stuff that goes on. So if you could do that with a true natural fibre, I think that would be a major game changer. And I guess I go back to GMO, because I don't know about GMO, you know, the science of it, but I can imagine if you want to kind of grow cotton in a factory setting, in an industrial setting, then you might need an element of GMO in order to make that cotton survive in those conditions, you know. So there might be a bit of them working hand in hand in order to get there. I think the other thing is the bio-based polyester that I spoke about earlier, that because polyester is not going away. It's an extremely it's a great fiber. It's cheap, it's durable, it's very versatile. But the problem at the moment is it's made from a resource that's going to run out fairly soon, probably within our lifetime. So it has, you know, there's an expiry date on polyester in its current form. So it has to change. And if they can get to the point where the bio-based polyesters are being produced on a mass scale and kind of costing the same amount of money, then that will be the next step. And you know, that would be quite a large step towards a sustainable fashion industry. I think the point with the bio-based polyester to remember is that although
it'll be huge.
It would, but you've got to remember that the bio-based polyester is using a natural product that's grown somewhere, you know, whether it's soybean or corn or whatever it is, there is another element to that polyester that we don't see that obviously, and that's the farming and how those plants were farmed. So maybe if you can combine that hydroponics idea, I suppose if you can nail that hydroponics idea and grow all types of plants in an industrial scale, then you're kind of solving a lot of issues then, because those plants could go into cotton or linen or polyester. So hydroponics, it's the buzzword today.
Yeah, and become truly circular.
Yeah.
It is. No, it's great. Mark, thank you so much. I really look forward to, as you say, to seeing those innovations. And it always amazes me what's going on behind the scenes. So many incredible things coming forward, and people really rethinking the past and changing things for a greener future.
There's so much going
fantastic.
On. There is so much.
It's brilliant. Mark, thank you so much for your time today. Your insights have been incredible. Our listeners are going to absolutely love this episode. Thank you so much. And keep up the good work. You're doing an amazing job out there. It's fantastic. Oh, have a great day, Mark, and speak to you very, very soon.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
See you.